It's Tuesday, March 18, 2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The big news on St. Patrick's Day in Boston and New York City is not what happened, but what didn't happen. In both of those cities, the Democratic mayors refused to march along with those who were celebrating with the Irish community their most cherished holiday, which is St. Patrick's Day. And this is news because the reason is the same in both two cities. The parade organizers, both in Boston and in New York, largely Catholic, of course, given their Irish identity, had refused to allow people to endorse a sexual orientation by means of their participation in the march. In particular, as the New York Times explains, organizers of the annual parade there have said gay groups could march in the procession but could not carry signs or identify their sexuality. But this raises a very important issue for our worldview consideration. What we're witnessing in this great moral revolution taking place around us is not merely the demand that homosexuals be incorporated into the larger culture, but that homosexuality be accepted and celebrated within the culture and publicly so. That's what's really behind the news coverage and the events related to these parades. Newspaper after newspaper and television station after another has indicated that the problem, as they see it, with these marches is that gays, quote, were not allowed to participate, end quote. But that's not true. No one was checking the sexual orientation of those who participated in these parades. But what is going on here is abundantly clear. Those who were organizing these parades did not allow the endorsement of homosexuality. Of course, they did not screen people by their sexual orientation, but that gets to what's really going on here. At the end of Romans chapter 1, in that long list of sins that includes everyone who has ever lived, the Apostle Paul says that God's condemnation comes not only to those who do such things, but to others who give hearty approval to those who do them. That's now what's being demanded of us. And these parades yesterday in honor of St. Patrick in Boston and New York make the point emphatically. The New York Times reports that major corporate sponsors of the parade there withdrew because of the policy not allowing openly gay groups to advertise sexuality issues. The Guinness Company withdrew after other major beer companies withdrew, and they had been the major corporate sponsors for that St. Patrick's Day parade in New York City. In Boston, similar controversy. As a matter of fact, just about the only major corporate sponsor of any of these parades was the Ford Motor Company, and you can count on the fact that they'll be receiving a great deal of criticism for having had anything to do with these parades. The two mayors of these respective cities in Boston and New York both said that they would not, in principle, participate in these parades, even as many of their voters are, of course, Irish. They said they're not going to participate because they can't participate with discrimination. What's being discriminated about here? Not the sexual orientation of those who march, but the ability of people to advertise a moral statement in the midst of a march. And in this case, a moral statement that every sane person knows flies in the face of the Catholic organizers of these parades. Now, we need to recognize that there was no major civil rights issue involved in this. There is no major threat to religious liberty involved in this. No one has any right to obligate anyone to march in a parade like this. And the right of the parade organizers to have their own principles involved in choosing those who can and can't march, that was settled by the United States Supreme Court on an appeal from a case having to do with the Boston St. Patrick's Day parade. What is at stake here is what's happening in this moral revolution. The demand is not merely that there be the full incorporation of homosexuals in every arena of public culture, but that homosexuality be celebrated. Make no mistake, that's the issue. The controversy over these two parades makes that abundantly, even transparently clear. Sunday's edition of the New York Times had two very important articles on theology in that one issue of the paper. Even though the paper may not have recognized there were great theological issues at stake, it was very clear that they thought the two stories were compelling. The first is a story by John Leland. The headline is this: A God-optional group seeking relevance in worship. It's not about a Christian group, but a Jewish group. It's about a group led by a descendant of 37 generations of Orthodox Jewish rabbis. Quote, he is also a gay man who lives in the East Village, a fan of the Smiths and Emily Dickinson, a father of three, the creator of a drag character named Hadassah Gross. On the screens was an image of a sacrificial lamb taken from a Dutch painting. Quote, some of you are synagogue veterans or synagogue survivors, he said to the congregation. He asked them to contemplate how modern ideas of sacrifice might apply existentially, experientially, to their everyday lives. What you have in this article is the depiction of a new model of Jewish spirituality, a model that is explicitly atheist and agnostic embracing. It is a God-optional synagogue. You're thinking of some parallels probably within the evangelical world, and, well, so did the New York Times. For instance, here is how the reporter described what took place in the synagogue. Quote, "It resembled nothing so much as a modern evangelical Christian church. This man, Mr. Lau Levy, invited congregants into the big tent. Quote, it's a God-optional, bring-your-own-God, do-it-yourself-God, everybody-friendly community." End quote. Now, the reason the reporter for the New York Times saw an obvious parallel with Christianity is because this is exactly the approach that is being taken by some on the evangelical left, as well as some in mainline Protestantism, who are trying to say you just have to meet people where they are and let them develop a new kind of spirituality that will in some way incorporate Christian symbols. As the New York Times reports, these are precarious times for non-Orthodox synagogues in New York. According to a 2013 survey by the Pew Research Religion and Life Project, fewer than one-third of American Jews belong to a synagogue, and barely one-quarter say religion is very important in their lives, compared with 56% of the general public. The share of Jews living in a household where anyone belonged to a synagogue fell to 39%. In a 2001 survey, that's just about a decade earlier, it was 46%. The reporter in this case, John Leland, points out that the decline is especially noted in Reform and Conservative Judaism. But that's where we have to intervene and say, here's where the language gets pretty interesting. As you heard the article, he said that in non-Orthodox Judaism, there is this precipitous decline. Orthodox Judaism is Judaism with an explicit continuity in terms of belief and practice with Judaism throughout the centuries, rabbinical Judaism especially, since the medieval era. But when you're looking at Reform Judaism, you're looking at a liberal movement that long ago abandoned any explicit theological expectation for its membership. Conservative Judaism was the middle position, and as is the case with most mediating or middle positions, it shifted left. It shifted left pretty fast. As a matter of fact, the fastest declining group within Judaism in the United States is what's called Conservative Judaism. What this tells us is that those leftward-leaning Jewish groups are losing members, and they're losing those members fast. Having made God optional, a lot of people figured out they don't need God. And if they don't need God, guess what? They don't need Judaism either. One rabbi facing the decline said, quote, "We're in a veritable explosion of experimentation." Another said, "The Pew study tells us if synagogue life won't innovate, then we're going to continue to lose people. I'm convinced," he said, "we're blessed to live in a marketplace that forces us to hone what we're doing," end quote. What the article makes clear is that theology here is nothing more than an experimental, consumer-directed issue. In other words, we'll find whatever beliefs will resonate with people, and those are the beliefs that we'll teach. In this case, this particular innovative synagogue has no theological expectations whatsoever. In fact, you don't even have to believe in God. You don't actually have to believe in Judaism. You just have to believe in some form of spirituality that leads you into this predominantly Jewish enclave. The New York Times says that this rather radical rabbi, quote, "finds himself part of a coterie of religious leaders, Christians as well as Jewish, asking a nearly impossible question. In an increasingly secular, technological, consumer-driven culture, how can they revise worship in a way that is relevant to people who have unlimited demands on their time and weak ties to institutions?" End quote. Let me just point out the obvious here. If that's what you think the most important question is, you're going to end up with something like a God-optional synagogue or a God-optional congregation, a God-optional church. If you think that our great question, the question we face, the challenge we face, is to come up with a theological system, an order of worship that will appeal to people in a post-Christian secular age, then what you're going to have is a post-Christian secular church, or in this case, a post-theistic Jewish congregation. If you're accustomed to hearing people criticize traditional Christian worship as being out of date and out of step, then you'll understand why the same things are being said in this article by these rather radical Jewish experimenters, innovators they call themselves, when they look back at traditional Jewish worship. Quote, "It's really long, all in Hebrew. People go up, down, sermon, whatever. It's an hour. Whoever is there either has their nose in the text trying to follow along, or they just check out, go in the back, go outside," end quote. Mr. Lau Levy, the rabbi in this story, says that he decided to change the sermon into storytelling, and evidently he's a rather creative storyteller. Describing the rabbi, the paper says being gay had made him comfortable with challenging orthodoxy. Either scriptures were wrong or he was an abomination, which he rejected. In other words, if it came to what he knew about himself or what the scripture said about himself, the scripture would have to go. Also very clear in this article is an understanding that religion is just a human construct that people will do with as they will. He said, quote, "What matured in me was the sense that Judaism, like all religion, is not the bottom line. that it is a tool in our toolbox for human well-being and being helpful beings, and that there is a difference between many people who really view Judaism or religion as the end goal. In other words, keep the Sabbath or marry a Jew so the Jewish story continues. That's, of course, how I grew up. I realize that that's missing the point, end quote. Well, if you think that's missing the point, you end up in this kind of synagogue described in the New York Times. But we need to recognize that here we face the very stark choice. Either religion is just a human construct that we can construct and deconstruct and reconstruct at will, or it is a revealed truth. If it's a revealed truth, then it's not ours to do with as we might wish. It's rather ours to accept and ours to obey. As I said, you just might see some parallels here with those churches that are called emergent, and the New York Times recognized that as well. The rabbi himself said, quote, "Emergent churches and synagogues are both moving away from traditional institutional forms to reflect a broader cultural shift. People coming to synagogues or churches now want to be in a relationship, not a contract. They want to be in a network, not an institution," end quote. You know, I can't imagine when I saw an article that was more explicitly theological in a newspaper like the New York Times. Here you have a direct challenge made to us. Either religion is a human construct and nothing more than a human construct, or it is a divinely revealed truth. And if it is a divinely revealed truth, our options are few. We can receive it or we can reject it. We can believe it or we can disbelieve. It is not ours to change. The response is to be belief and obedience. Those are issues completely missing from this article and from the synagogue and from the worldview of the New York Times. But one article laden with theological importance wasn't enough for Sunday's edition of the New York Times. No, there was another article, this one by Michael Paulson. The headline was this, "Denominations Downsizing and Selling Assets in More Secular Era," end quote. The article begins in Boston, where we read, "The American Unitarian Association, peopled and powered by this city's Brahmin elite, announced its presence here in 1886 with a grand and stately headquarters at the very top of Beacon Hill, right next door to the State House. If anyone doubted," says the paper, "the denomination's might, its next move made it clear. In 1927, strapped for space, the Unitarians finished building a new home next to the Capitol on the other side, even persuading the legislature to change the street's numbering so they could take their address with them," end quote. So what we're looking at here is an historical look back to the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, when Unitarianism was a vastly influential religion in Massachusetts and especially in Boston. But things are now clear. As the paper writes, "But the Unitarian Universalist Association, as the denomination is now known, is selling its headquarters building as well as two grand homes and an office building it owns in the same neighborhood. It is leaving behind the red brick sidewalks, gas street lamps, and super rich neighbors. For a section of South Boston, the city is designated a, quote, innovation district, end quote, home to up-and-coming technology and arts businesses." Now, the New York Times finds this interesting from the perspective of religion, theology, real estate, and cultural development. Its point is this: denominations are in decline and they don't need those big buildings anymore. And there's money to be made in selling them. As a matter of fact, the Unitarian Universalists may get tens of millions of dollars for selling their facility. But they're not alone. The article makes very clear that United Methodists are now ready to sell their publishing headquarters in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, likely to music interests. The Jehovah's Witnesses have been selling their property in Brooklyn. The American Baptist Churches, headquartered in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, have been selling their property and leasing it out, as has the Episcopal Church USA. With its very tony and expensive headquarters in Manhattan, it now has leased out property to a French-American school and to other agencies and corporations as well. As the New York Times explains, and I quote, "Multiple religious denominations, citing everything from diminished financial resources to a need for more contemporary office space, are simultaneously downsizing and raising money by selling longtime headquarters in expensive neighborhoods. The moves come at a time when increasing secularization in the United States is taking a toll on many religious institutions, although most say the reasons for their relocations are not solely financial," end quote. Well, even if the financial issues are not the sole, not the only issue, they clearly are important issues. It's impossible to take the financial out of it when you consider the membership losses that these denominations and churches have experienced. But this article is really interesting as it deals in particular with the Unitarians, now with the Unitarian Universalist Association. The paper reports, quote, "The Unitarian Universalist sale stands out because of that denomination's long and close association with Boston. The move is also striking because the denomination's membership numbers are not falling. The official membership is low, about 160,000, but has remained flat as mainline Protestant rolls have dwindled and denominational officials say their finances are reasonably healthy. Instead, they say they're moving because their buildings, including the offices of their publishing house, would require millions of dollars to upgrade. But they're actually, as the paper makes clear, saying something else. They're leaving this very establishment, wealthy, super wealthy area of Boston for a corporate district. It's described in the paper as something far less grand. As the paper says, denominational officials who now cherish the golden light of the sunset reflected off the Massachusetts State House dome will instead look out at a parking garage. And visitors, accustomed to staying in colonial brownstones, will now be offered discounted rooms at a local hotel. The end of the article cites the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, who called the existing headquarters, quote, a building that was really designed for another organization and another era. He concluded, quote, given the changes that are happening in religion today, we all have to move to the Innovation District, end quote. Well, I found that absolutely fascinating. Two articles with deep theological importance in a single day's edition of the New York Times, not a paper known for its extensive coverage of theology. But theology is inescapable from these two stories. It's inextricable. When you look at these two stories, at this God-optional synagogue in New York City, and at the sale of the headquarters of the Unitarian Universalists in Boston, there are huge theological issues. One of the most important theological issues has to do with the fact that Unitarian Universalism still exists. And oddly enough, it may finally have come into its own. If you're looking for a post-Christian religion that just might sell to a secular audience, it's hard to come up with anything better situated than Unitarian Universalism. The UUA was established in 1961 when two different denominations came together, the Unitarians and the Universalists. The Unitarians go all the way back to early Christian heresies. They deny the doctrine of the Trinity. They have redefined the deity of Christ so that he is mostly human and only in some symbolic way generally divine. The Unitarians are classical Christian heretics, as understood by the Orthodox Christian churches. And now they were joined in 1961 by the Universalists, who also find roots in the heresies of the early church. They have argued against the reality of hell and have argued for a long time that all persons eventually find their way into heaven, into full acceptance by God. So the Unitarians and the Universalists got together and formed the Unitarian Universalist Association in 1961. But the New York Times takes us back to a different era, to the late 19th century and the early 20th century. In those times, in Boston, the Unitarians were huge. They were hugely influential. They were the intellectual elite of Boston at the time. But they are no more. Unitarianism and Universalism fell out of favor. Again, the total membership is now estimated to be about 160,000. But you know, if you look at this faith, it says, all ways lead to God. No one's in danger of hell. Jesus is a good and honorable earthly teacher. You don't even have to believe in God. The Unitarian Universalists, just like the synagogue there in New York City, don't require anyone even to believe in God. They're so anti-creedal, they're so anti-theological, that you don't have to believe anything to be a full participant in their churches, even a minister or the president of the denomination. The document known as the Principles, Purposes, and Sources of the UUA cites seven different principles. They are these: the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. In other words, no God. Their statements don't even refer to deity. This is such an anti-theological denomination that there's no theology in their most important statement of principles. But according to the president of the UUA, if you want to be relevant these days, you have to move to, quote, the Innovation District, end quote. And that explains why the New York Times found such interest in a God-optional synagogue and in the sale of the property of the Unitarian Universalists in Boston so they could move to the Innovation District. The options for the Christian church have always been abundantly clear. It's either orthodoxy or heterodoxy. And heterodoxy doesn't just mean one thing opposed to orthodoxy. It eventually means all things opposed to orthodoxy. In other words, once you abandon orthodoxy, anything goes. And the great dividing line is where it always has been, between those who are committed to the fullness of biblical authority and to everything that the Bible reveals, and those being revealed binding truths, and those on the other side who see the Bible as nothing more than a fallible human witness and see theology as nothing more than a human construction. Worship is no more than that which is constructed in order to give human beings contemporary meaning. In other words, when the New York Times said the future is in the Innovation District, we'll just consider the two examples they've given, the Unitarian Universalist Association and a God-optional synagogue in New York City. Oddly enough, they eloquently make the point. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Remember, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call with your question in your voice. Just call 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll be speaking this morning in chapel at Cedarville University in Cedarville, Ohio. That's at 10 o'clock this morning. Perhaps I'll get to see some of you there. I'll also be speaking in chapel on Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock as well. I'll meet you again tomorrow for the briefing.